In the years since it became a ubiquitous part of people's lives, the internet has created new models for all kinds of businesses across many sectors, but none may be as ambitious, mysterious, or controversial as Bitcoin. Like alchemists, the developers and early adopters of this electronic currency have tried to create value out of thin air in order to challenge the world's monetary institutions and reorient finance to fit the internet age. In his new book, Digital Gold, New York Times reporter Nathaniel Popper chronicles the exploits of the cryptologists, ideologues, criminals, entrepreneurs, and financiers who have come to value the new currency and have turned it into a lucrative and unpredictable industry. The book is published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased to welcome Nathaniel Popper to our show today. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me.
In the simplest terms, what is a Bitcoin?
What is Bitcoin? Boy, 7 years after this thing was invented, I think that's something that even people who are involved with this struggle with. And I think that's in part because it's actually a lot of different things. But the two easiest ways I like to think about it, it is a sort of digital gold. It's a, you know, it's this token that's scarce that can be moved around online. So it's the digital gold from my title, I think, hints at that. And then I think it's more than just a token. It's a whole network for supporting money. And in that sense, it's sort of like an email for money.
But based on an algorithm.
The underlying network that supports this is supported by a lot of complicated math and cryptography.
What are the physical Bitcoins with the logo that we see in the news?
Yes, those are pictures that are picked up by newspapers because they can't find anything else to illustrate stories about Bitcoin. And so those have led many people to think that there is some physical Bitcoin. They're really kind of trinkets that were created by people essentially as a way to store your cryptographic password. But you can just as easily do that without a physical Bitcoin.
But you need to have a code on the coin.
Yeah. You know, at the very most basic level, I think people sometimes find it helpful to understand that Bitcoin at the most basic level is about a Bitcoin address, which is a lot like an email address, and that's 34 letters and digits, and then a Bitcoin password, which is known as a private key. And when you have that private key, you can unlock the coins in your address and send them anywhere.
How does Bitcoin fit into the model of what we understand as a currency?
That's a great question. I think one of the basic questions that still swirls around Bitcoin is, you know, this question, this definitional question of, is it a currency? Is it more like a commodity?
Or a security?
A security. You know, regulators are struggling with this because they need to figure out who's in charge here. And I think that frankly, the virtual currency label that's been applied to Bitcoin is a little misleading, at least at this point. I mean, currency is something you can exchange for goods and services, and Bitcoin can be exchanged for goods and services. You can buy stuff on Overstock with it. But because the price has bounced around so much, and for other reasons as well, that's not how it's mostly used, and that's probably not the best way to think about it. That's why I tend to use more this kind of idea of a commodity, a scarce asset, a lot like gold. It's just a digital asset instead of a physical asset. But of course, the long-term ambition is that this is a currency. This is, you know, people talked about it from the very first day as a sort of global reserve currency like the dollar.
And since it's been adopted by libertarians, Rand Paul is accepting Bitcoin donations to his presidential campaign.
Yeah, it was amazing that on the first day of his campaign, he announced that he would be accepting donations in Bitcoin. I think this was really, more than anything else, a way to kind of signal his alliance with the kind of hacker WikiLeaks crew that has also attached to Bitcoin.
Do you think that they vote?
That's a good question.
Judging from what you've written about here, I don't think these are people who tend to go and wait online to vote.
You're right. I think that, you know, one of the things you saw when Bitcoin was getting started in 2008, in 2009, it was the sort of, you know, at that point, the Ron Paul supporters. And many of them did talk about when you have a candidate like that, then you do go out to vote.
But you can't use it to pay your taxes.
You cannot use it to pay your taxes, certainly in the United States. There have been efforts elsewhere. Actually, one of the computer scientists at the center of my book, a guy named Gavin Andreessen, lives in Amherst, Massachusetts. And he told me recently that he's been trying to negotiate with the Amherst authorities because he's gotten his paycheck in Bitcoin. And so he's trying to find a way to pay his taxes there. But that would be a first.
Isn't part of the problem in creating an alternative to currency that it's still valued by the established currencies?
Well, yes. I mean, this gets to the root of you know, so many utopian schemes where they imagine this future where their perfect system is the ruling system. But how do you get from here to there? Yes, in the end, their vision is that you will get paid in Bitcoin, you will pay your taxes in Bitcoin, you will be able to buy your food with Bitcoin. But right now, we live in a world in which goods are not denominated in Bitcoin, and so you have to move between dollars and Bitcoins. And that's really been the hurdle that Bitcoin hasn't been able to get over. Getting banks to play with them, getting money in and out of the system is where this whole thing has struggled.
And since its value fluctuates so much, it becomes confusing, I would imagine, to a bank.
Of course. Well, that's one of many reasons that the banks, I think, have been nervous about this. You know, the quasi-anonymity of the system gives them pause. You know, the drug dealing that's gone on using Bitcoin, the potential for money laundering. I mean, all of this has banks very nervous about this.
Doesn't producing new coins require huge amounts of energy?
Yes. The Bitcoin,
should that be a concern?
I think it is a big concern within the community. You know, this gets at the very sort of cryptographic, you know, shadowy way in which new coins are created. Initially, the idea was that people who plugged into the system would get the new coins. And initially, you could do that with your laptop. But as time went on, it was designed so that the same number of coins would be released every 10 minutes or so, no matter how many people were using it. And so as time went on, it became harder and harder to get them. And now it's this specialized art that requires specialized computer chips, cheap electricity. Much of it is going on in China at this point, but other people have moved their operations to Iceland and Washington State, where they can get cheap energy. So it's very much a sort of industrial operation at this point.
So it's expensive to create it because you're spending so much on electricity.
Exactly. That's the kind of limiting factor. And that's why a Chinese chip manufacturer that can, through their corrupt relationships, get, you know, plug directly into their local coal power plant, they're sitting pretty because they don't have to pay the electricity costs.
Without an authority like a central bank, how are transactions verified and made safe? What's a blockchain?
Well, yeah, I think that's the one part of the system that really has worked and that has led to the recent interest from Wall Street. But to take it back to the most basic level, you know, every financial system is based on some sort of ledger where the accounts are kept. Who has what money? Usually that ledger is kept by a bank. In Bitcoin, the sort of innovation was, we're going to have a ledger, but everyone is going to keep it on their computers. And so everyone can watch what everyone else is doing. And if one guy steps out and says, I've just added 1,000 Bitcoins to my ledger, everyone else has their own copy of it and can say, no, you don't. So it's this communally kept spreadsheet in the sky, essentially.
But there's an upward limit of Bitcoins at 21 million. To prevent inflation?
Well, I think there were a number of reasons that limit was put on from the beginning of the system. You know, on day one, when the mysterious Satoshi Nakamoto released this software, he said it would be 21 million. They'll be released slowly until about the year 2140. And that was, I think, for a couple of reasons. One, in the wake of the financial crisis, it was to appeal to the kind of libertarian mindset, the folks who believed that money printing by central banks was a problem, that it was, you know, corrupting our financial system. So I think that was part of it. The other part was that it provided an incentive for people to join in and join the network because it was this scarce resource. And so it seemed as though if you collected it now early on, it might be worth something later on.
Most of the news about Bitcoin has been about how volatile the price has been. Why is it so difficult to stabilize?
Well, at this point, It is a tiny, almost entirely speculative market. There's 14 million coins, and people aren't really using it on a day-to-day basis yet. And so people are essentially speculating on some future use of it. And it's not yet clear what that's going
to
be.
So how can it function as a currency if people keep waiting for the value to go up?
Well, I think that it's probably not going to serve as a currency until and if it takes off in other ways. So until, for instance, people use it as a store of value online, like people use gold. But also, there are many other complicated uses. It's, you know, things that people are talking about right now, Goldman Sachs getting into this, the New York Stock Exchange getting into this. They don't want to use it as a currency. They want to use the underlying system. And so people are now betting that that's going to take hold. And it's only once something like that takes hold that the idea of a currency might be able to be borne out.
You mentioned Satoshi Nakamoto. In the book, you cite an article in Newsweek from a year ago that exposed what seems to be the wrong man as Satoshi Nakamoto.
Yes.
Do you have any alternative theories?
That wasn't the first time that people have fingered the wrong person. Ever since Satoshi Nakamoto, that's the name attached to the creator of Bitcoin, essentially disappeared into the ether in 2011, people have been trying to find the wizard behind the curtain. I think now we've gone through a lot of the obvious names. In the course of my reporting, you know, the conversations about this always came back to one person, a guy out in California, grown up in Washington, been a longtime privacy activist and a longtime experimenter in this idea of the money of the future. And he'd come up with something named BitGold before. This is a guy named Nick Szabo. And he was a sophisticated coder, a thinker, a kind of reclusive guy. And so people inevitably sort of thought, he's the best candidate. But I spoke with Nick in the course of writing this book. He, of course, denied it. But
you'd expect him to.
Of course. That's what Satoshi would do. And so it's this crazy kind of Borgesian mind game that you get into where you're kind of constantly looking for these hints and fingerprints and digital trails. One of many sort of fascinating parts of this story.
My guest is Nathaniel Popper, who's written Digital Gold, Bitcoin, and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. It's published by Harper. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Nathaniel Popper, who covers the intersections between Wall Street and Silicon Valley as a reporter for the New York Times. His book, Digital Gold, Bitcoin and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money is published by Harper's. How did cryptologists become the center of the early days of digital currency? And who were the cyberpunks?
The cypherpunks were an early, one of the first online communities, got started in the early 1990s. And these were folks who were technologists, but were very anxious about some of the unintended consequences of technology, and most particularly as it applied to privacy. They realized that as you live more of your life with a digital, you leave more digital footprints, essentially. And very quickly, they honed in on money as one of the primary places where you leave these sorts of digital footprints, as anybody can see looking at their credit card bills. And so they began thinking up new kinds of money that would make it easier to transact anonymously, as you can do with cash in the physical world. So their idea was, let's create digital cash.
But you say that you can, if you are in the Bitcoin world, you can know what everybody has.
Yeah.
So where is the privacy apply there?
It's a complicated mix, and Bitcoin is probably not as anonymous as a lot of those original cypherpunks would have wanted. What you have for anybody is their address, this mix of letters and numbers. If you can tie it to a person, then their anonymity is gone.
Is it seen as kind of a community, as much a social network as a financial one?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's what drew me into this story, was that this is really a social movement. This this rose and has succeeded to the degree it has and has failed to the degree it has because they've managed to get new users. Money requires people to use it, and it's only as useful as the number of people who do use it.
How did the first major exchange for Bitcoin, Magic, the Gathering Exchange, evolve from a website dedicated to trading game fantasy cards to a place where Bitcoins were traded?
Yeah. This is the site known as Mt. Gox that was created by a kind of surfer kid from Arkansas named Jed McCaleb, who discovered Bitcoin early on when they really weren't worth anything. And, you know, just as a kind of experiment, he started, he built this website in the course of a couple of days to allow people to buy and sell Bitcoins. He got sick of it. He kind of did it in a slapdash way, and he sold it to another young a French guy who was living in Tokyo, who took it over and ran it to the end, at which point it had about $500 million worth of customer Bitcoins, which it mysteriously either lost or had stolen from it. And one of the remarkable elements of the story is that even he doesn't seem to know what happened to that $500 million of money.
The first successful business to use Bitcoin, if you want to call it that, was Silk Road. Of course, its founder, Russ Ulbricht, is now in prison.
For life, yeah.
How did the original adopters of Bitcoin feel about the fact that their best promoter was a drug merchant? Well, did they know that?
Yes, absolutely. It's fascinating. The first 2 years of Bitcoin, these things were worth nothing because you couldn't do anything with them. People were getting them for free from the network, but there was nothing to do with them. And there was actually a conversation about what is going to be the first thing that is going to make it worth somebody for, worth it for somebody to use this. And there was a thread on the Bitcoin forums about a potential heroin store. People thought, you know what, that's something that an anonymous online money would be useful for. And into that thread, Russ Ulbricht wrote his first post saying, I've created the Silk Road. He didn't write it under the name Russ Ulbricht, but he said, I've created a new kind of marketplace, essentially an eBay for all the things you can't buy on eBay. And you can buy drugs for Bitcoins here. And it just grew from there.
Did the more ideological figures like Roger Ver feel conflicted by his commitment to libertarianism and the use of Bitcoin to buy drugs?
No, I mean, I think it was honestly that the ideological component to Bitcoin's rise early on was a lot of this sort of libertarian anarchist fringe, among whom, you know, there was a view that you should be able to hold your own money, you should be able to be anonymous, but you should also be able to enter into transactions freely if you want to, even if that means buying heroin. And so I think this was all of a worldview of sort of complete personal freedom.
Now, many of the people whose stories you tell here, Charlie Shrem, for example, the fraternity brothers from Georgia Tech, the whole Silk Road story, they're American. But there's a foreign aspect to this as well.
Yeah.
There's a man named Wences Caceres, the founder of Chapo, and he's from Argentina.
Yeah, I mean—
Is their Bitcoin involvement totally different? Are they also libertarian?
I think it might appeal to libertarians here, but it is not at all sort of political or ideological in the same way. And, you know, that is indeed one of the most fascinating things about Bitcoin is the way it's developed. You know, it's the same technology being used everywhere, but the kind of users it's attracted have been entirely different in different geographies. And in fact, most of the activity is now going on outside of the United States. So obviously, Argentina, you've mentioned, one of the most fascinating stories to me, because here's a country that has had real problems with their own currency. They've had these numerous bouts of hyperinflation. You know, there's very limited access to the financial system there, so most people don't have credit cards, they don't have bank accounts. And into that situation, people have brought Bitcoin and said, here's a way for you to be able to purchase things online if you don't have a credit card. And here's a way for you to be able to move money in and out of the country to pay for something overseas that our government won't allow you to buy. And so there you see the Bitcoin gets cast in a very different light. It really is providing somebody with an ability to do something that they couldn't do under the existing restrictions.
And then there's Bitstamp in Slovakia.
In Slovenia, yeah.
Oh, Slovenia?
Yes. It was founded by a couple of young friends. That was one of the successors to Mt. Gox. I mean, in Europe, part of what's interesting is that you've had less of the libertarian element and more of the kind of Occupy crowd in Europe who's seen this as a anti-corporate movement, you know, something to strike back at the banks. Here's a way to take control of our money back from these corporate interests.
Although banks have been getting involved, haven't they?
Yes. That's one of the great ironies of this story, is that the latest developments in it involve the very entities that Bitcoin was designed to circumvent, government and Wall Street, coming in to try to take their place in this. And so Goldman Sachs recently made the first big investment in a Bitcoin company. JP Morgan has a 25-person Bitcoin working group that's looking at this technology.
And then there's Fortress Investment Group, Don Moorhead.
Yeah, well, they were the Wall Street firm, a sort of hedge fund private equity firm that led the push into this. He was actually sort of sold on the idea by Wences Casares, the Argentinian we were talking about earlier. And Fortress is one of these hedge funds that's looking for these disruptions in the economy, these opportunities to make a killing, essentially, on some inefficiency in the system. And what they saw was that the way money moves around now, the way checks work, the way basic money transfers work, is incredibly inefficient and expensive. And there is an opportunity there.
Some of the first people to start to legitimize Bitcoin were a young man from New York City named Charlie Shrem, and also a couple of fraternity brothers from Georgia Tech who came up with similar ideas, separate from each other.
Yeah. I mean, they were among the early entrepreneurs in this space who realized, okay, this isn't just useful for drug transactions. There are actually real world use cases for this that could make us real money without requiring us to break the law.
And some of the people within that world are uncomfortable with these guys. His mainstream respect for authority prompted some of them to call him statist.
Yeah. Charlie Shrem.
Which is a dirty word in this world.
Charlie Shrem, who has moved very far from being a statist since he was insulted in that way, was early seen as a sort of accommodationist. And that's been the tale of Bitcoin. It's been this struggle between this kind of utopian vision of overthrowing the banks and overthrowing central banks and the government, and those people who just want to see this as a technology that can do something useful. And there's incredible tension there that was playing out when Charlie Shrem got started and is still playing out today.
What did he do that made the exchange of Bitcoin easier?
He essentially, his was a very simple innovation. He created essentially a sort of e-trade for Bitcoins. It had been very difficult for an American to deposit money and purchase them. That was the first step. It wasn't incredibly innovative, but it was something that was needed at the time.
Now, this world is largely secretive. Who among the major players in the saga did you personally speak with?
What was amazing was that despite the kind of desire for privacy in this world, almost all of the early players were willing to essentially open their kimonos for me and share everything, share their emails, share, you know, transcripts of their conversations, legal documents, their battles. And I think that's because they viewed themselves as being at the center of something that was going to change the world. And they wanted to be seen as a part of that story. And so they gave me incredible access when I went and visited them in Tokyo and China and Argentina. And there was incredible, these tensions that played out behind the scenes were just laid out in incredible detail for me.
Do they still think it's going to change the world?
Absolutely. I think some of the early enthusiasts have become a bit more cautious about how long it's going to take. I think some of them said, you know, within 2 years, this is going to spell the end of the Fed. Now I think they've recognized, you know, this is a long-term project, but they're still very much in the fight.
If I wanted to get involved with this Bitcoin world, if I wanted to start trading in Bitcoins, what would I have to do? Do I go Google Bitcoin?
You could certainly go Google Bitcoin. You would pull up a couple of American companies that have now been funded by some of the top venture capital firms in Silicon Valley who make it incredibly easy to buy and sell Bitcoin. And a lot of what's happening now is companies saying, okay, we don't just want to make it easy for you to buy and sell Bitcoin. We also want to make it easy for you to transfer money to your relatives in Mexico or Argentina more easily and cheaply than Western Union would. So they figured out, the buying and selling part, and they're trying to sort of layer on top of that.
And then what would I do with them if I had them?
What would you do with them if you had them? Well, I think that this gets at the international issue that you mentioned earlier. I think there's a recognition that people in the United States are probably the last people who need Bitcoin. Our credit cards work pretty well. It's pretty easy to buy things online from Amazon. It's pretty easy even to send money internationally. I think a lot of people are viewing this as something that now has the most potential in places where people don't have credit cards, things like that.
But in this country, the appeal is partly that it is anti-government.
Yes. There is now a divide in the United States between those early ideologists, the folks who are drawn to this for political reasons, and then the Silicon Valley Wall Street types who view this as a technology that's going to be important for much more practical reasons. And those people are investing large sums of money. So that's the question is how quickly they're going to be able to kind of take this over completely from those early guys.
And do you see a future in which Bitcoin does become an important factor in world finance?
I think that at this point, the most likely outcome is that this becomes essentially more like the back end on which money is moving that people aren't necessarily aware of. What people may become aware of is that their money transfer is moving a little bit more quickly. Maybe it costs a little bit less money, but they don't actually think of it as happening with Bitcoin. It's the network that's doing this new Bitcoin network. And that's, I think, the more likely outcome.
Is Wences Caceres correct in thinking that Bitcoin will help Argentina's economy?
I think it's still, at this point, it's being used by, I don't know, maybe 10,000 people in Argentina. It still has a lot of growth, but it is doing something right now.
Nathaniel Popper covers the intersections between Wall Street and Silicon Valley as a reporter for the New York Times. He's also worked at the Los Angeles Times and The Forward. His book, Digital Gold, Bitcoin, and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money, is published by Harper. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.